No one told me.
It's always going to be just out of reach.
Wow, do these people know something I don't know?
Like, the more hours I spend talking in public, the more chances I'll say something wrong and get in trouble.
The good girl archetype was going to be the ruination of the world.
It was this wake up, cosmic wake up.
Just walking around exclamation points jumping off me at all times.
I love messy humans.
You wanted this life. This is your fault. You chose to do this.
This is The Art of Asking Everything. I am Amanda fucking Palmer, and as I record this, it is Monday, November 9th, 2020. Biden has just won the presidential election. Donald Trump may or may not go quietly into the night. Probably not. And I am personally petulantly angry that my life is hard because my 5-year-old child won't go to bed so that I can go into the kitchen and record the intro to my last minute podcast with Nadia from Pussy Riot. And I lie there and I think about what a coward I am because Nadia from Pussy Riot was in prison for 2 fucking years when she was in her early 20s with a small child of her own back then. And I imagine her lying in bed at night in prison thinking about her child. And I think, what problems do I actually have at all? And then I think that, you know, all problems are still problems. I think about my conversation with Nadia, and I think Nadia would probably agree. Nadia Tolokonnikova is a Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and the co-founder of Vladimir Putin's least favorite band, Pussy Riot. In 2012, she was convicted of hooliganism motivated by religious hatred after a performance in Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Savior and was sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. She is the author of How to Start a Revolution and a book called Read and Riot, a Pussy Riot guide to activism, as well as a book called Comradely Greetings, The Prison Letters of Nadia and Slavoj, which documents her time as a political prisoner. She's also been the subject of multiple documentaries. And Nadia and I sat down screen to screen and talked at length on a Zoom call a couple weeks ago. I was in Aotearoa, New Zealand. She was in an undisclosed location. And we spoke about coping with the pandemic, Putin, Trump, RIP, how she found punk, what punk even is and means to people, how we decide what mediums to use when we want to speak with art and music, how prison brought Nadia closer to her mom, the importance of books and information, and how, most importantly, we find solutions for people left outside the systems and how we can do that right now. Comrades and critics alike, please welcome Nadia from Pussy Riot. Thank you so fucking much for doing this and coming on this podcast, especially right now with what is going on in the world. Oh my God. 200,000 people marching in Belarus, 200,000 people dead in America. How are you? Like, skipping everything, how are you doing right now as a human being?
I'm trying to develop myself. I'm trying to stay creative, and it's working out good for me. Obviously, it's really pressing and emotional in a bad way to read the news about pandemics. And it's sad to read that people are dying. But personally, to me, I was trying to use my prison experience as an example for treating this pandemic. So, you know, it's not a pleasant or positive experience, but you can try to make it work for you. So in the beginning of pandemic, I've decided to apply certain routines for myself, like, I don't know, exercising, learning, reading books, learning new skills, easy stuff that a lot of people are doing right now. And it really works for me. I feel like I'm going to get out of this pandemic if me and my family members and my loved ones are going to be healthy. I'm going to get out of here stronger person because I have more time with myself and with people who I love. And that's really cool. It forced me to stay at one place for longer.
Yes.
And that's cool.
Me too. Yeah. And if you're really fucking busy, traveling, busy person, that's very confronting.
Yeah. How do you feel right now? What about you?
Thank you for asking. I feel really strange. I've been away from home for 6 months by accident. I've become a single mother sort of by accident. Like none of this was in the fucking plan. I just feel like I am in like a survival mode, but also at the same time, I'm in one of the most beautiful and safest places on the planet. So I'm like overburdened with gratitude that I'm not in New York, that I'm not in Australia. You know, this synchronicity and the weird coincidence that I was like, I was on tour in New Zealand for 1 week, And then I just happened, this is where it happened to happen. So I happened to be here when it happened to happen. And just trying to synthesize all that and like the weird survivor guilt that I lucked out, but also all this shitty shit has happened in my life at the same time. And I wake up every day going like, this is it. And I'm sure you get that. Every day there's shit where that you can't believe how unlucky you are and simultaneously how lucky you are, whether you are in a prison or in a hospital or in a home or whatever, like there's a pile on either side.
What are your practices to stay sane?
My main thing has been to do less work and to spend more time with my 5-year-old. Like he is the thing that's kind of grounding me. Like on a very practical level, I've started going to bed, no shit, at 8 o'clock for the first time in my first time in my whole life. Like I'm a night person. I'm a touring person. I'm a performer. I'm used to going to bed at fucking 3 o'clock in the morning on and off tour and waking up at around 10 or 11 all my life. And in the last few months, I started going to bed with my son at around 8 or 9 and I wake up at 5 and I'm trying to drink less wine. Like those are my two things right now. I have a lot of things to ask you. And I reached out to my Patreon. Patreon is one of the things I want to ask you about too, because I know you have and run a page. And I asked my patrons if they had any questions for you. And our questions are all kind of like merged together in one big pile. But first of all, you are fucking loved by people, just so you know. Like if you needed a daily affirmation and reminder, you have so much respect and so much love and admiration from so many people in my, at least in my little world. If you needed to know that today, you should know that.
I need to know it. Thank you so, so much for your support. Guys, girls, non-binary people.
All beings. I always want to work on the assumption that this podcast is going to be listened to by people who know very little or nothing about you. Even if I give a very well-researched and lovely intro, which I'm sure I did. And for the sake of the argument, let's say you had an American 12-year-old girl, intelligent enough, American 12-year-old girl, who had no idea kind of where Russia is, who you are, what you have done. And all she's heard is this little intro that this thing called Pussy Riot exists and this woman named Nadia exists. How would you explain to her what your country is, what's happening there and what was happening there, let's say back in 2012, and what you did in a way that a 12-year-old could understand it? How would you explain that story?
My daughter is 12 years old. She's from Russia, though, so she would not be that person, but I can relate to 12 years old really well. Let's start our little fairy tale. In 2011, when you were 3 years old, in a country called Russia, Putin decided to be the president for the third time, and he never asked his people if they wanted to see him as a president for the third time. They just announced it on a little gathering of white heterosexual males who just told us on all the media channels that are controlled by Kremlin, by Putin himself, that Putin is going to be the president for the next 6 years. Putin, at the time, Putin wanted to be the president forever, basically to be an emperor. And he was looking up to another dictators like Kim Jong-un in North Korea. He also likes the leader of China. So that was his big example. So when he said that he's going to be president for the third fucking time, we were deeply troubled. And we realized that something is going to change in my country, which was not ideal. Our democracy was not ideal at the time, but we still were able to do certain actions without being punished. Like, for example, one of my favorite actions that we've done at the time was called storming of the White House. In 2008, we stormed the White House. We projected giant 40 meters long skull and bones on the Parliament of Russia. We call it White House as well as in the United States. Mm. And we stormed it. A group of people ran, climbed on the fence, 6 meters fence, and ran through the territory of the White House and left from another side of the fence. And the idea of that action was to show people that actually the power is much more fragile and unprotected than they like to be seen. And if a group of anarchists, kids can do it, then imagine what if a million people would go in front of the White House and refuse to leave until the Putin is gone. So those kind of actions, they went unpunished in 2008. And in 2011, the end of that year, we realized that if Putin is going to become president again, then it will mean that the amount of freedoms that we're going to have are going to shrink. We didn't want that to happen. We've decided to form a band that's called Pussy Riot because we were fans of Riot Girls. We wanted something like that to happen in Russia. And we wanted to bring it to the streets. We wanted to perform it in guerrilla style for everyone on the street without permissions, because we would never get a permission to perform our songs because they were all about, you know, feminist rebellion, LGBTQ rights, and fuck you to Putin. You would never have permission to perform that in my country. So we performed at places like public transport and the Red Square and at the fancy, glamorous shops where people buy things and rarely think about politics. They rarely think about human rights. We went illegally, guerrilla. Again, we went to fashion shows to make people think about politics and how important it is. We were singing for political prisoners on the roof of the jail. And our performance that brought us to jail happened in the church. But it wasn't a real church. It was a trade center of Christ the Savior, as we call it, as a lot of people call it in Russia. Yeah. Well, official name is Cathedral of Christ the Savior. But in fact, they have a lot of luxury shops inside. They have a luxury car wash. There are a lot of rooms for rent that if you have enough money and if you're good enough, you can rent them to make a concert. So it means some performers who praise Vladimir Putin, they actually perform in the cathedral. So it's not so unusual.
Got it.
And we went there without permission. As I said before, we would never get it. And also, we didn't have any money at the time. We lived for 6 years by shoplifting. We didn't want to, you know, sell our labor to an unequal, unjust system. And we performed 40 seconds of the song, and then we were kicked out by the guards. They were not offended. They were annoyed, possibly, by a bunch of girls singing feminist song.
Being loud.
And singing about protest. Being loud, yeah.
Yeah.
We performed exactly at the place where the patriarch of Orthodox Church would normally make his prayers, his performances. And one of our points was that it's really weird that in these times when was all the feminist, all the female empowerment that's happening around us, Russian Orthodox Church is not reflecting it at all. Mm. And still, a woman cannot be a priest, and still Orthodox religion is one of the most conservative powers in our country that constantly calls for things like dress code for women. They are showing, they're publicly talking about things like if she was raped, she was asking for it. Typical slut shaming. So Russian Orthodox Church is not progressive, to say the least. And we went there to talk about it. We went there to start dialogue, to start a conversation. And instead of talking to us, those guys have decided to imprison us. They put us in jail for 2 years. And it's been a rough time, but you know, we're out, and since we've been out, we kept working on the same issues. We became just stronger. We became more convinced in our activist philosophy. We've seen they proved us. The government proved us that our activism is needed. Mm. And unfortunately, today Russia has even more political prisoners. So if you can help them anyhow, do it.
At the end of this fairy tale, you get out of prison a little early in a move from the government. You said it was cynical. Their theatrical release of you was a bullshit move to just desully the brand of the Winter Olympics. And there you were, reunited with your child, first of all, back in the world with an infinite number of choices of what to do next. You could have done a lot of things in the spectrum. You could have just been like, fuck all of this. I need to take 5 years off. I'm tired. Overwork yourself to death now that you've got a voice and a platform and you know that people are listening. One of the biggest questions I have for you is not so much as an activist, but also not discounting that because of course you're an activist. As an artist, you got to choose which medium to work in. Or like try to do every medium. So you put a book out and you were putting videos out and doing actions everywhere at once. But having thought about it, and maybe your opinion has even changed since getting out of prison, and maybe your opinion has even changed since COVID, when you look at all of these artistic outlets, or even don't even call them artistic outlets, just call them media outlets, like, I'm going to talk to you this way, no, this way, no, this way. What do you see, especially right now, as being the most effective way for you to not just do what you want to do and say what you want to say, but also be a fulfilled fucking human being so that you're not just going on a speaking tour, getting behind podiums going, I pump my fist and fuck Putin, but you know, you can do it using all of these different containers, and you have to choose on a daily basis which container you're going to pick.
By nature, I'm a multimedia artist. And one of my mentors was a poet, a sculptor, an architect, and a writer, a musician, Dmitry Alexandrovich Prigov, and a performance artist, first of all. I was first introduced to contemporary art by two men, by my dad and by this person. Well, I didn't know him personally, but I saw his performance when I was 13 years old. And I've decided that I'm going to live my life as Dmitry Alexandrovich Prigov. So the thing that I was fascinated with is that he was constantly changing mediums in order to run from a certain identity, and it gave him freedom. When people would tell him, oh, you're a poet, he would be like, oh no, I'm not a poet, I'm drawing pictures, I'm a painter. And then oh, you're a painter, he was like, oh no, I'm actually making sculptures. And he never was satisfied with just one label being stick to him too much. So he was always somewhere in the middle. I went to study philosophy to my Moscow State University, and then I was reading Foucault, and I don't know if it's right or wrong conclusion from Foucault, but at least that's what my artistic brain concluded from reading Foucault and writing works on him, that I can find interesting angles and kind of truth about life through being on the margin of things, on the intersection of different fields. Because then you have a really interesting point of view on everything that's happening. So since early age, I've decided that that will be my life. When I got out of jail, I kind of just followed that method of combining different genres. And one of the genres became reinventing punk through thinking about what is actually punk today in 2014 in Russia. It occurred to me that actually the most punk thing that I could do in 2014 was to build an institution. And a lot of people were not in agreement with me. I got a lot of criticism for building an institution because they were like, oh, you're not...
A lot of criticism from within your own scene?
From punk community, yeah.
Yeah.
It was in the line of, I mean, we have to fuck things up and we have to be always against and stuff. And I was against, but I also remember about important tradition in punk movement of building alternative institutions, building an alternative world, creating DIY institutions, I mean, labels, magazines, zines. It always was a part of punk culture, not only going to the street or to the main square and telling everyone to fuck off, which is important, obviously, but not just that. So in 2014, we've decided to build an organization that helps prisoners, provides them legal help, first of all, helps them to fight against their oppressive prison system and help them to go to all levels of courts that can protect their rights, from all the Russian courts to European Court of Human Rights. And then when we realized that we make this important human rights work, but there is no one to write about it and to tell people about what's going on in prisons, in a few months, we've decided to start Media Zone, which is a media outlet, which exists up to this day, and it became one of the most influential independent media outlets. And it was really challenging because I was 25 and, you know, my colleagues were around the same age, and we never had experience of building an institution. It was interesting, but we kind of succeed because right now, if you look at the amount of awards and just attention and trust from people, from regular people in Russia, from media, from our colleagues, journalists, you can see that it's a credible, awesome, fucking awesome institution. So that was one of the mediums. But also we've decided that this platform that was given us, it's not ours really. So I felt kind of possessed in 2014, right after I got out of jail. I felt possessed and not fully myself. I felt like I have to tell stories of other prisoners. I have to tell about prison conditions to as many people as possible, to everyone who wants to listen. So we traveled a lot. We gave a lot of lectures and speeches at European Parliament, to the United States, Senate of the United States, and many other places and colleges. But then in a year, I realized that I'm starting to lose myself. First of all, I'm an artist. I'm an activist, but first of all, I'm an artist. So after a year of being possessed and totally giving myself to the activism, I realized that I need to bring back artist part. And I started to work on music, which became my main medium. And right now, I'd say 70% of my time I spend in coming up with new tunes, new tracks, and making music videos for them.
I want to ask you a question, a simple, easy question, or maybe it's not. But like, there you were, a teenager in Russia. How the fuck did you find out about Riot Girl? Like, who brought that into your life? Where did it come from? Did it come from the internet? Did it come from a store? Did it come from someone you were having sex with? Like, how did this poisonous, toxic, vile music get into your collection? Where did it come from?
I didn't even have internet until I was 16. So I was growing up in a bubble of Russian culture.
Yeah.
With little access to what's happening outside. And then I moved to Moscow when I was 16. And in a few years, so I was kind of an adult. I was 20 when I learned about Red Girls. We were working on a lecture about feminist art, and we called it punk feminism. It was a funny situation. We came up with the name punk feminism because we thought it's cool. We got booked at one event, and we started to prepare just a night in advance before the lecture, as we always do. And we realized that, oh, there's a Riot Girl movement over there, really far, but there is nothing like that here in Russia. So we had to come up with a Russian version of punk feminism. And at that night when we were writing this lecture, well, obviously we compiled a lot of information about Western punk feminism, but also we had to point on something inside Russia. We couldn't find anything, so we had to record it at that night. And we did it in a bathroom. We did it in my friend Kat's apartment, and at the time she still lived with her dad. And her dad is super against feminism. He didn't like me. He thought I'm kind of a devil who is trying to turn his nice daughter into feminism, all that stuff. And he even witnessed against me in the court later. He was trying to prove that his daughter never saw it in that way, and she was totally influenced and manipulated by me, which was not the case. But anyway. So yeah, he was trying to, it was an interesting moment of trying to record the first Pussy Riot song.
You're going to record a song, but what had you heard before going in to record that song that made you, that created any kind of idea of what punk was or what it sounded like? What had you already heard? Like, what ingredients were there in your palate to know what punk even sounded like? Because clearly, like, you knew the concept and you had an idea about it, but how did you know what to do?
Well, we had my friend's dad, and we wanted to reply him in an artistic way to tell him about the importance of punk. What did I hear? Well, I've heard a lot of stuff, but it was not particularly, I mean, it was not as feminist as I wanted it to be. I mean, obviously. I mean, so, I know I went to Iggy Pop's concert. I loved, okay, of course, David Bowie is not punk, but he's kind of like, in my weird imagination, he is punk because of his revolutionary aesthetics. I've been listening to Nina Hagen, Patti Smith.
And so where did that music
Bikini,
come from?
Bikini Kill.
Like, how did you know?
From Torrents.
From torrents, and so from basically torrents, from the internet, like you just going down the rabbit hole of the internet and following the breadcrumb trail until you got to Iggy Pop and you were like, that speaks to me.
Iggy Pop came from a person I've been fucking with, but
wait,
some other
fucking with like. Or fucking, fucking with or I'm, fucking I'm, or I'm, both.
I mean, fucking with and fucking, yeah.
When you toured and you did a lot of touring, you know, you must have had some ideas about punk and the community, what it was, what it meant. And like when you got out into the real world, did any of those illusions get shattered? Like about what punk meant and what the faith that people had in punk was, the belief system. And like, did you come up against the punk fascists, and did you come up against people pointing at you saying that's not fucking punk and this is what is punk and how dare you call yourself punk and like we are the punk police and we're here to arrest you? Like, did that happen while you were on tour, like in any way, even in the press? Like, did you find yourself feeling misunderstood?
For sure. I'm still fighting with it because I'm trying to redefine punk, and I think this is the most punk thing that a person can do, to think about what punk would sound or look like in 2020 or 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Try to imagine punk in the future and make it now. Obviously, it's not going to sound or look like it used to be. It used to look like in 70s or 80s, 90s. To keep being punk, you have to constantly reinvent yourself. By doing that, it means that you cannot follow any rules, including punk rules. This puts you on a really difficult path because on the one hand, you are not with mainstream art, mainstream entertainment world community. You're not making pop music. So you're not playing by their rules, but at the same time, you're not playing by the rules of punk as a music genre. So you end up in between of all genres, and even algorithms, they have an easy time with this, because when I send my songs to Spotify, they don't really know where to put it. They and the editors of Spotify playlists, even if they're sympathetic to what I believe in, they don't know where to put me because it's not exactly pop, it's not metal, it's not punk, it's not alternative.
Yeah.
And where would you put me?
And in this way, you have fucking succeeded in your goal of trying to be like your unpinned downable mentor hero, because that's like often the key to some of the best artists is like, I don't know, you like, you fucking decide what to call this. It's not my job.
Yeah.
Like, my job is to make this thing, and your shitty job is to try to explain it and find a Spotify box to put it in.
Hopefully they will do their job, and we will definitely continue our jobs. But yeah, I do have a lot of people coming at Pussy Riot shows who meet me and other members later. Normally it's white men in leather jackets and
in
their 40s or 50s. And possibly they drank a couple of beers at the time already. So they're like slightly drunk and they're trying to explain me what punk is and why don't you play guitar? That's the biggest question.
Well, yeah. Currently, you can't, have punk without guitars. That's not allowed. Didn't you know that? That's punk 101.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, right now we're actually playing the show with guitars, and I feel like a conformist because of that.
You but, feel like you're rebelling against your own rebellion of fuck guitars.
Yeah. Well, when I started to write pop music for the first time, it was 2015. I was trying to reinvent how Pussy Riot should sound, because when we made Pussy Riot for the first time, we didn't care about sound at all. So we cared about performances, we cared about performance art, making actions on the street, about our political statement, but we didn't care about the sound. So in 2015, after I went through jail, I went through my activist period, the year when I gave myself fully to activism, I decided to focus on creative side. And it actually brought me to pop sound for a while. I mean, a little bit weird, distorted pop sound, but still pop sound, because I was rebelling against expectations.
Yes.
People's expectations of, because when I was telling them I'm working on an album or on EP, everyone was like, oh, you must be having guitars and drums and
of course
guitar.
It's going to sound just like La Tigre or some spectrum Bikini between La Tigre and the Sex Pistols. And that's exactly what it will sound like, because that's your job, because you're a punk band.
Yeah. So I, as you, I never wanted to have a job. So I felt like at that
wait
point,
a second. When I never just said I didn't want to have a job. I just wanted a job that I liked.
Well, I personally, I never wanted to have a job. When I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I had a teacher who was giving us economy lessons, and she was one of those who loved neoliberal economy and stuff. And she was like, "Okay, there are 6% of population who would rather be homeless than have a normal job." And she told it to us like, oh, look at those people, they're so disgusting. And then I was like, oh, I'm actually proud to be those people. I'm for sure in this 6%, because I cannot be a subversive artist if if I'm having a normal job. I just want to make a remark that what I'm saying doesn't mean that you cannot be a subversive artist by having a normal job, because if you figured it out for yourself, that's good for you. But that's how I felt at this time.
Well, and can I just challenge that and say, like, maybe we are allowed to call being a subversive artist a job? Maybe that's the fucking answer, is that I was just literally talking with a friend this morning about that. And it's something that I write about a lot in my book is, you know, I was raised in a culture where being an artist was not considered a real job. It just wasn't in the list of jobs that you were allowed to want as a child. And then, like, subversive artist is like one step beyond that. Like, you could want to be, yeah, so you could maybe want to play violin in a classical orchestra. Okay, maybe that's a job, kind of. But you can't want to, like, be Yoko Ono or, like, be a performance artist or actually go make bizarre, possibly non-paying street art that doesn't have a direct source of payment or salary, because that's not a job. And actually, that's bullshit. You can make that a job. Like, you've made that a job. I've made that a job. A job can be fucking anything as long as you can, like, pay rent and stay alive. Yeah, and maybe it's just about redefining, like, what we can teach a child what a job is. And maybe we just have some piles where it's like, those are more normal jobs. Banker, shoemaker, plumber, politician, ugh. But over here, here's some other jobs. Here's some other options. Like, you can still make a living, but they're not really on the normal list, but they're fucking valid.
I struggled a lot as a kid with that. I mean, the reason why I didn't speak with my mom for years was because I picked the job of a philosopher. And
wait a second. That's really not a job. No, just kidding. It's a job. If you can get a job,
around me
you can
just
get a
like
job.
Making fun of me for 3 years in a row, because I knew that I'm going to study philosophy. Mm. And I would be like, I don't know, when I was hanging with my grandmother. My grandmother treated me seriously, but all her friends, they were just making fun of me. They're like, who's going to pay you for being a philosopher?
Are they all eating their words now? Because you are actually kind of getting paid to be a philosopher who works in different media.
Well, my mom is pleasantly surprised, because she told me that I have to get a real education first, and then I can get whatever I want. And so first I have to become a lawyer or an economist.
Okay.
I have two options.
Great options.
And then I just, I kind of ran from my house. I didn't literally run, but I just told my mom that I collected enough money to get a ticket for a plane, just one-way plane from my city to Moscow, and to try to enter university. So she couldn't do anything, because I already finished my school, and no, she couldn't keep me physically. So she just had to agree.
So how does your family feel about what you're doing right now, and how do you get along with them? Is it easy? Is it hard? Is it complicated?
It's really easy. My mom started to support me again when I ended up in prison. Mm. So in a weird way, I have to thank prison. I have to thank Putin for bringing me back with my mom. Mm. So at some point, yellow media, like yellow journalists, they pro-Putin, pro-Kremlin, they knew that I had a beef with my mom. Mm. And they made an interview with her where they asked her about, like, oh, what do you think about your daughter? What do you think about what your daughter is doing? And they hoped and they knew that my mom would be like, oh, I think she's, I don't know, slut, things like that. And she didn't do it. She, on the opposite, she was like, I support my kid. She's awesome. She's telling the truth. She's, you know, she's the best. And I read it when I was in prison and I felt like, it's just like something really important happened in my life. Yeah. And since then, we're friends. And with my dad, they're separated with my mom since I was 5. So it was like completely two different stories. My dad is super artistic and weird. And so I never had actually problems with him. And he was teaching me how to question authorities. So for him, it was natural what I've done with my life.
Good.
What about you?
You know, my parents, I think they're proud of me, but also confused by me. And that's just like the ongoing paradox of being me. But the older I get, I think the more peace we were able to make with each other. And also the less I take for granted how much freedom I had growing up in a house where they weren't musicians, they weren't artists, but they encouraged my weird passion towards theater, towards art, towards doing plays in the backyard and staying up all night and playing piano. You know, they were sometimes irritated by me and they would tell me that I was making too much noise or whatever, but they never discouraged the concept that being an artist was possible. They never told me it was a stupid idea and that I should get a real job. I mean, a lot of the rest of culture was telling me that, but my parents never did. And the older I get and the more artists I talk to and the more origin stories I kind of synthesize, I really don't take that for granted. I appreciate them, that they just didn't get in the way of this big, weird thing I wanted to do.
It's a lot.
Yeah, just not getting in the way is huge. And I mean, that's true in general with a child. Like, you know, my son just turned 5 and I'm just trying so hard not to shut anything down. Like, I know how dangerous it can be and how fragile they are. And you can say one offhanded negative thing and like a whole world will shut down because they're so vulnerable to your opinion. And I just want him to think like anything's possible. I can do anything. I can be interested in anything. I can be good at anything, regardless of gender and this culture and where we are. And I just try so hard to stand back, which as an opinionated person is fucking hard to do, right? It's like a real humbling as a parent. I don't know if you've gone through the same thing with your daughter, but I fight that all the time, like the urge to tell him my opinion. And I just don't, because I want him
to
have his own.
Isn't it a paradox for a progressive parent to let your kid have more conservative views than you have?
If
I didn't actually encounter it. Yeah, but that's, imagine how challenging it is. Because, I didn't have it with my daughter yet, but she's super progressive. But, you know, she will want one day. I think it will be the most challenging thing for me, but I'll work really hard to accept it, because otherwise I'll be just like any other conservative parent who would not take what their kids are thinking for, like, as a real thing.
Yeah.
I think respect and treating a kid as an adult, as a person, is the key. And that's what my dad always was doing with me. Even when I was a toddler, I think he was talking to me like I was a real person, and they can feel it.
Yeah,
it really works. Then they listen.
And the truth is, they are real people. They're just young.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, smarter than the older people, like wiser, because they don't have all of these cynical boxes that they've put their thoughts in like we have. And they're smart. I mean, I feel like I look at my son sometimes and I think he's smarter than I am in a lot of ways. And I mean it, you know, that's not in a like a kitschy sentimental way. That's like, he hasn't unlearned how to be open-minded yet. And there's a lot I could learn from him. Like, he reminds me how fucking big the question can be. I was looking at your YouTube channel and I saw a film called The Penal Colony, and it's made by somebody else, but basically based on your story and based on an open letter you wrote. I had a couple of questions about that. First of all, it's really striking. I saw that David Lynch was thanked and I was like, where the fuck did that come from? And also, you know, this wasn't a film made by you starring you, constructed by you, but it's obviously it's up on your official YouTube channel, so it's probably blessed by you. Can you just tell me the story of it? Because I want to know. And I also want to go out and share it, but want to know that I have your blessing to go out and share it, to just make sure that it's not something that you did under duress.
Well, I was not tortured to upload this video on my YouTube.
That's good to know.
Yeah, that's good to know. Well, I had little to do with the creative side of this movie, because I think the team who decided to make this movie, they were inspired by my hunger strike. So at the time when they started to work on the movie and in the script, I was still in jail. But then after I got out of jail in 2014, I met with the team. I met with the actress who played me, and they were really nice and really like interested in prison reform, and they have views that I share. They're leftists and some of them are anarchists, and I felt like it's amazing that a group of creative people want to make a story based on my prison letter, because honestly I didn't expect it my prison letter to have such a big impact as it had. So it was even translated to English, it was published in Guardian and probably to other languages as well, and went all around the world, and it was impactful enough to make someone to make the whole movie about it. So it was, I wouldn't say flattering, but it was a gesture of solidarity, of global solidarity that I religiously believe in. Mm. And so it was a good sign. A few years later, they sent me the film. And though it was really weird for me to look at actors playing
me. How did it feel sitting there and watching your story depicted through somebody else's lens?
They captured some of the things really vividly. But I think the older I get, the older the movie gets, it was released in 2017, the more I accept it. Because in the beginning, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, it wasn't exactly like this. Like, you know, the penal colony looked different. I don't know. I got some distance personally from my experience of penal colony, and I realized that there is no way that those guys would get inside my actual penal colony and film it in there. Mm. There is no way they would know how it looked like at the time when I was in prison. I couldn't tell them. It's okay to have some sort of distance symbolism. Well, you know, it's okay that things are not looking in the movie exactly like they looked in my penal colony. And it's an important movie. And if you care about human rights and prisoners' rights, probably you should watch it. Because it depicts, it depicts the fight. It depicts my fight. And, you know, it was not just me. It was my fellow prisoners. It was this big fight with our administration that brought the administration to the court. So now my prison warden is facing years in jail for the slave labor system that he built.
How does that feel?
It feels amazing. I remember 1 year ago or 2 years ago. Yeah, a few years ago. When I was in Costa Rica, I was doing something important in there. I'll not tell you what, but
okay.
I was doing something important. And by the way, I've decided to go on the beach. And so I was sitting on the beach and reading news about my ex-prison warden being brought to a court trial for building a slave labor system. And I was like, this feels fucking awesome, because I remember how violent, emotionally violent he was to me. Like he was probably the first person who showed me what abusive relationships are. And it wasn't, we're not in those kind of relationships, but he was emotionally torturing me. He would ask me to come to his office several times a week, and he would talk to me for hours about how small I am and how big he is. And how he owns me. He owns my life right now. And he was living through, like, you know, he was getting energy through realizing how much power he has over me right now. He also loves to read about me on the media to know that actually Pussy Riot is kind of influential. But right now, at this moment, I'm totally in his hands and he was just sucking energy from it. So knowing that, experiencing all of that, I definitely felt really rewarding reading news about his possible jail sentence.
Yeah, you must have had a huge sense of justice being served.
I didn't expect it. I didn't. When I wrote this letter, I was totally thinking that it's going to get lost. You know how many important things, important activist things are getting lost in the media. And I was lucky.
Especially now that you've got a little bit of space from 2012 and 2014 and like all the stuff that came after it, and you have some perspective, and there was like celebrity and fame and news and attention for the right reasons and maybe sometimes attention for the wrong reasons. Do you look back and you feel like you learned, like outside of just your particular activism and Russia and the stuff that you were trying to get done, like, do you feel like you learned anything about the media and celebrity that really shocked you and that really changed the way you looked at using it as a tool? Like, did you go in naively think like, oh, all these celebrities want to help me, so they must be aligned with my cause, like only to realize that like not everything out there is what it seems?
Well, they don't really want to see me anymore because Pussy Riot is not such a hot topic right now. And we kind of settled down as a movement, but I feel much more comfortable right here, right now, than right after our jail time, because it was too overwhelming and it was not something that I wanted and I didn't know how to deal with it. I think one thing is when you always want to be a famous person and you imagine it, you go through this, you play this role in your head before it happens with you, and then it happens with you, and then you're totally fine with it. So it wasn't our case at all. So when Madonna and Yoko Ono would want to meet us, I felt nothing because I felt so emotionally overwhelmed by everything that was happening. So my emotional system just shut down and didn't feel anything. Also, I was experiencing big PTSD after prison, so that was a really awkward year. So anyway, years after, I feel more comfortable because everything went back to the scale I'm comfortable with.
Yeah.
And regarding dealing with media and celebrities, well, I think that's okay that everyone has their own interests, but I have healthy skepticism about some of them. I think as long as first you understand the context, as long as you understand motivations of people that are talking to you, and as long as you know that you can tell whatever you want without being censored, that's okay to talk with anyone. And so for this reason, we were meeting people who not exactly in line 100% with our ideals, but who can help us, let's say, to bring closer the prison reform in Russia.
Yeah.
Like when we went to the Senate of the United States, we definitely were not in love with everyone who was in there.
Right.
But we used it as a... you know, we would always prepare ourselves. We would meet activists first, local activists. Like, let's say if you're performing in Australia, we would talk with local migrant rights activists and local feminists to hear from them, like, what are important issues that are not being brought up in your local mainstream media? Like, do you want to call specific members of the government to action. And so we would always get a little bit of context of what's happening, and then we bring it to the crime scene.
Yeah.
So when we came to the Senate, we talked not only about Russian prisoners, not only about Russian political prisoners, but we spoke also about Occupy Wall Street prisoner Cecily McMillan, who was in Rikers Island at the time. And we went the next day after we gave this big press conference with this the senators who were not ready to hear about American political prisoners. We went to Rikers Island to visit her and to listen to her story. So I think as long as you think and analyze the situation, it's okay not to stay in your niche. Because that's a big conversation inside punk communities, you probably know.
Right.
Like if you can meet certain people, if you can collaborate with certain media, like kind of punk go and CNN.
Right.
I think yes, as long as we can say whatever we want.
Did you, especially in those years after getting out and like going nuts and touring around and talking, touring, traveling, did you meet anyone who you felt really slowed down and saw you that didn't necessarily need anything from you, like someone who felt like a real ally and maybe even stayed in your life as a, like, oh, this is a person who understands me, whether it was a celebrity or not, another musician, a journalist, like, did you find any soulmates?
Of course. I think if you don't find soulmates, what's the reason to be alive?
I agree. It doesn't mean that it happens easily, right? Especially if you're going at a really fast pace and it's like go to a place and go to an interview and get on a train and get on a plane. Like, it can be really hard actually to slow down to the speed to create the conditions for that. And this is what a lot of touring musicians go through, is like, it all happens so fucking fast that you're barely living because you're just so busy outputting.
It's funny, but not. I don't know how to describe it in English. Okay. It's much easier to find soulmates when you are in prison than when you are on a tour. Because in prison, you find soulmates and people who you would not consider as those in real life, right? Because you just constrained in four walls with this person who is an ex-investigator, ex-cop, basically. Mm. And she's the only one person who's going to see in the next year, probably. And we made friends. We became friends with an ex-investigator who used to be on another side, and now she became a friend. But yeah, this difficult to on the tour just because you don't have enough time, and also you have just limited amount of energy, and I'm an introvert, so that's even more difficult for me to connect with a lot of people at the same time.
Yeah.
But just today, me and my daughter, we hanged with Paul Villeman, who is a creator of House of Cards and other amazing shows. We connected with him when we made a speech at Penn Gala in New York. We were supposed to deliver a speech about the importance of books for prisoners. And we encouraged people to, if they can, to send books to prisoners, because it's, you know, book is one thing when you're free, but in prison it becomes your whole world.
Yeah.
And if you don't have access to good books, it means you don't have access to anything. Oh, yeah. So we started to talk with him, with Ba, and in 20 minutes, he was like, oh, do you want to take part in House of Cards? We were like, I mean, that sounds, I mean, we're curious.
We're curious.
And we did it. So it's been a lot of years since then. I think it's been like, we met in 2014, and he is an example of a person who went through a lot of things in life with us, and he would always be really attentive and thoughtful. And when things like, I don't know, poisoning of my ex-husband, the father of my kid, Peter Verzilov, would happen, he would always offer his help. And even if you're a touring musician, if you're on a constant run and your schedule doesn't give you a lot of opportunities to connect with people, it's still possible.
Yeah. When did you realize you were an introvert? It surprised me when you said that.
When I was a little kid, when I first read this classification, then I realized. Well, I think it's really, as any classification, obviously, it cannot be taken as an objective reality.
It's not non-binary. I believe in the non-binariness of introversion.
It's a spectrum.
We're all somewhere on the spectrum. Exactly. But do you feel that you need more time, alone and to process than your average person?
Well, introverts are average people too, right? Even according to binary classification, there are half of us. But when I was a kid, I didn't go to parties or meetings. So I would have really limited amount of friends, and I would not see them too often as well. But I think finally, I realized that I'm an introvert for sure at university, when I realized that I cannot go to lectures every single day. I need at least 3 days a week to just spend time alone by myself, with books, with cinema.
So if that's the case, how did you survive and take care of yourself on the road? Because the road is constant people, constant talking, constant togetherness. And even if you like the content of the connection, it can be so exhausting. How did you deal with that, and how did you take care of yourself?
Well, I think I would give you universal answers. If you're touring with people with who you feel at home, if you're comfortable with them and you're comfortable and close with them enough to tell them, I need to be alone right now, and I don't know, shut up. And they can tell you shut up.
Yeah.
Then you feel much more comfortable when you don't have to put a face constantly.
Right.
Right. And then just control the amount of communication, because you don't have to speak with every single journalist who wants to speak with you. At some point of my career, I thought I have to, because there is something I need to tell them, for example, about conditions in Russian prison, or about the state of democracy in Russia. And if someone asks me, it means I have to necessarily speak with them. And I would bring myself to the point of exhaustion. And some point I realized that it will not help anyone if I'll kill myself emotionally trying to do that. So I would rather focus on, several important things that I'll decide for myself that are important for me to do right now, important conversations. So I would limit my interactions to a few a day. And I think with age, I'm just getting more easy on myself. Sometimes when I feel like I want to tell everyone that I need a long time, I should not feel guilty about it.
No. Oh my God.
What about Ian?
I've been going through waves since having a child, because, I went on tour last year and I did a 4-hour show, not every night, but, enough nights of the week that I was often exhausted. And I just, similar to you, I think I started to try to become aware of, the script in my head that was about what I should be doing and how tired I should or shouldn't be. And I started to just listen and be actually, I know I shouldn't really be tired right now, but I'm really fucking tired and I just have to lie down, even though it doesn't make any sense. And now I just need to ask for a day away from my child, even though I've been away from him and I know I should want to spend time with him. That's not what's happening. I'm too exhausted to be present for him, and it's probably better that I just go away and rest so that when I reunite with him, I'm actually there. And I just started being more realistic about stuff that I had never really wanted to be realistic about, like sleep and how much I was drinking and what I was putting into my body, like all the really unfun grown-up shit that you just don't really want to believe is true. You know, you really do want to believe that you can get by on 5 or 6 hours sleep, and it's just not true. And you really do want to believe that, like, if you've worked your ass off, you deserve to drink a bottle of wine and catch up with your friends. But actually, it's just not great for the next day's work. And all of the stuff that I think I had been avoiding for a long time about taking care of myself and what it actually looks like and what it actually means, instead of the old script and the list in my head of what reward is and what time is, you know, what time spent with what people is good and what is bad. And I just ripped up the script and started again, I think, especially after having a kid. I was like, oh, all these old ideas about myself and time are lies. So, you know, and I also, like, I had to accept becoming a person that I sort of feared being, because I was really ambivalent about having a child. And I talked about this a lot on my tour, and I've had 3 abortions, 2 by choice. And I really didn't want to turn into the person who had a kid and became boring and went to bed at fucking 8 o'clock at night, because I would see that happening to people. And I was like, you fail. How can you be interesting if you're having a child and going to bed at 8 o'clock at night? And now I am no longer interested in arguing with that 25-year-old version of myself who had ideas about what anything meant. She doesn't matter anymore. Her opinions don't matter anymore. Like, only my opinion right now matters, and what I need, and what I need to do to take care of myself today is all that counts. And being able to listen to that, and especially the pandemic, like, if I was already on my way there, it turned it up to 11. Because I just, I was watching myself follow a bunch of old scripts about what was good and what was bad and what was time well spent and what wasn't, and what phone calls I had to answer, and which, and I just was like, nope, this isn't fucking working. So let's start again.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have been going through that, probably, you know, especially people with kids.
What you told me remind me of things we talked about before about punk rules.
Americans, I think, and I can speak for myself here, have had a real kind of superior idea about our government being good and functional. And we look with pity at these poor other countries and their rigged elections. And now, like, it feels like there's a real reckoning in America about how things are run and who's really in charge. And you have a very particularly interesting window on that, given what you've been thinking about and singing about and writing about for the last 5, 10 plus years. What do you think about what is happening right now in America, a country that you spend time in? It's not like it's a foreign concept to you. What's your take on this current fucking disaster?
We are going through a crisis of mainstream political institutions, which are represented by people like Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and people are trying to say fuck you to the system worldwide, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. And it, so to serve to people's wish to say fuck you to the system, here come the right-wing populists who are showing up all around the world. In Europe, you can see Viktor Orban in Hungary. You can see it happening in England, in France, in Germany, and in United States. A lot of people feel not heard by mainstream politicians. They feel that their needs are not being met by neoliberal economy. And people like Donald Trump appearing all of a sudden, and they offer easy solutions, because that's what authoritarian or pro-authoritarian politicians are doing. they're pointing at easy targets to hate and to blame for all the problems that people are experiencing. And that's easy. That's just part of our human, it's a part of being human. We were looking for easy solutions, because if we would look for difficult solutions all the time, our life would turn into hell. So we cannot blame people for wanting to vote for Donald Trump. But I think what we want to do is to offer a viable solution to those people who feel left out by current economic system. And I feel like people like Bernie Sanders or Jeremy Corbyn, they're on the way of serving justice to those people who are who feel left out by current system. And it's just a matter of time when politicians, like left-wing progressive politicians, will be able to connect with those people who vote today for politicians like Donald Trump.
Mm.
Well, in the meanwhile, I really hope that all those people who believe that it's not important to vote, they will show up and they vote against Donald Trump on these elections. I'm here with Noam Chomsky, who I dearly love and respect. And I really love his formula. He's not naming for who you should vote, right? He's saying you have to vote against Donald Trump because it's a matter of survival. It's a matter of survival of the whole planet, because Donald Trump is one of the most dangerous politicians in human history. He is a climate change denialist, and he is willing to sacrifice all our planet, not just the United States, but all our planet for the sake of profit.
And especially because my patrons fund this podcast and will be listening to you. I find it shocking that you've got YouTube videos with millions and millions and millions of views and a huge voice and like, to use a really disgusting term, but to throw it out there ironically, brand recognition. And to only see a couple hundred people supporting your Patreon makes me really angry. Like, I want to see thousands and thousands of people supporting your Patreon, especially because your voice and your sort of lack of genre and the fact that you're multimedia makes you the perfect artist and creator and, you know, type for a platform like Patreon, where people are like, we don't know what you're going to do. You might interview, you might write, you might podcast, you might make pop music, you might make a dubstep track, you might just do a piece of spoken word, but like, it all is fucking valid and it all counts. And do you see a future in that? And when you look at your Patreon, first of all, how do you feel about it? How do you feel using it? And also, if you had your way, you know, would you wave your magic wand and be totally patron funded so you didn't have to make money in any other way, which is sort of like my fantasy direction. And especially now that touring is not just not profitable, but not possible. And we have kids to feed and rent to pay. You know, I've started thinking of Patreon as actually possibly one of the most effective feminist tools of the 21st century, because women, especially parents, will not need to answer to the commercial system and can just go direct with their art, their information, their message, whatever it is. And what have you, I mean, you've been on the platform for a little while now. What have you taken away from it? What have you learned, and what do you want?
You are one of the inspirations why I started Patreon. Because as many artists, I was one of those who didn't want to ask. I was thinking, especially if I, in a certain way, I'm a part of the entertainment industry business. So I was thinking, if I'm taking money for my shows, it means that I cannot really ask because it's not fair. But then I realized that I will never be good for the market enough, because I always suffer from my interactions with market, because I'm not, since I have no genre first, and second, since my job is to make statements that subverse as many status quo as possible, it's not realistic to find good funding through any traditional system. Let's say if I go to any of the studios, including non-traditional ones like Netflix or Apple, they would not fuck with me because they have Russian market and they don't want to lose Russian market. And if they... If
they wouldn't fuck with you, meaning they wouldn't work with you.
Work with me. Work with me. Yes.
Fucking with and working with and withing work and all of that. Right. They wouldn't touch you.
So I was just told by a woman who, an American director, who was trying to make a movie about Pussy Riot, or biopic, the story. She went to all the studios. She's really well connected. And she had an amazing cast, like the best Hollywood actresses alive nowadays, the coolest. They wanted to play us. And with all of that in a pocket, she could not secure any funding because all of those big companies, they have shares in Russia. They have the Russian market, and they're scared of it. Also, they're scared of being poisoned in the end of the day for doing this. So, I mean, this is just one example. The same goes, like, when I was trying to work with Warner Brothers, I was trying to make them fund my music. Leonid Blavatnik, who is one of the investors, and he's on the board of Warner Brothers, he said that it's going to happen just over his dead body because he has his financial interests in Russia. He's invested in oil and gas companies in there. So being in Pussy Riot and creating political art means following really an easy route where you meet some sort of obstacles when you ask for funding. So one of my Russian friends who is helping us to raise money for our media outlet that I mentioned earlier, Mediazana, he convinced me that it's okay to ask people who support Pussy Riot for money to fund our music videos, to fund our music production, and, you know, activist campaigns, media outlet that we create. It was not an easy decision to make, but I made it, and I'm really incredibly thankful to those 200 plus patrons who joined my Patreon, Pussy Riot's Patreon right now, because it's honestly the first time when I know that I'm going to get some sum of money in the next months, because it never been a thing in my life. Because then, you know, after the tour, you can get some money, but then you just waste them right away on music videos and music production. And
I've been doing that for 15 years.
And then you don't have anything. You just have to eat oatmeal and rice and beans. And
so
everyone...
does it feel different to know that you have that safety net of people and money no matter what happens?
I actually feel much less depressed. I have less anxiety. And though it's not money that I can actually fund my art today, but it's still a sum that will not go anywhere because it's provided by small donors. You know, some people might decide that they don't want to support Pussy Riot anymore, but all of them will not go anywhere. And that's insanely helpful for my mental health.
I have found the same thing. And I've been on Patreon for 5 years now, and I draw the vast majority of my income from it, and I have a small staff and I pay them out of that income, and that income being reliable means that I can have a staff and not have to tour or not have to put out a record. But there's something bigger than that, which is just knowing that these people are there and believe in me is so different from a label signing me or a Netflix signing me or someone thinking that I'll be able to help them make a profit. It's so much more comforting to go like, oh, you're not in this for the money. You're in this because you actually want me to do things. And they're like, yeah. We just actually want you to do things. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain to other artists. But it does do something to your feeling of value as an artist that is very different from even having the top brass at the top corporations like bonk you on the head with the magic wand and say, you're the one, because their motivation is so much shittier
than even 200 people saying, no, we just want to hear what you have to say. We don't even want to buy anything. We just want to support you in whatever your vision is. And that's priceless.
It's
the feeling it gives you is fucking priceless. And I hope that every single person who's listening to this, who's one of my patrons, goes and gives you money. Because I know that I have been supporting your Patreon and it makes me feel really good to do it. Like, it just makes me happy that my teeny pittance of contribution is, you know, is going to you to like help you and your life and your kid and whatever is going to come out the other side. It makes me happy to do that.
Thank you so much. And thank you for inspiration in all areas of life. And I know it.
And last but not least, we have a book club going on my Patreon podcast group, and we're going to read Read and Riot. And if you want to come and talk to us as a group in a few months or whatever, yeah, it would be amazing. I'd love to watch you answer questions from different people around the world and not just me. So if you're game to do that, let's do it.
I'm excited. I'm going to work soon on another book. So yeah, guys. I don't know when I'm saying it, but it's going to be, wow, it's the first time I'm actually saying it out loud. It's going to be a book about possible alternative futures. I'm going to imagine different utopias, like feminist utopia, ecological utopia, to have something to move forward to. And I'm going to interview, yes, a bunch of experts and scientists and artists, too, whose job is to think about possible futures.
Oh, my God. Come and talk to me about arts funding, because everyone is getting it wrong.
Yeah, like, I think so.
Really,
yeah.
When I think about a future for artists, I would just love to see no corporate dollars and no commercial shackles and no golden handcuffs of ad-based art and all of the things that are killing people creatively right now. I see it. I see it. It's out there.
It's out there 100%. And I swear to God this. I feel so much freer since I'm on Patreon and I don't have to talk. And I didn't have to take seriously charts, Spotify, labels. I just
algorithm.
Don't think about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really insanely liberating.
Congratulations.
This has been the Art of Asking Everything podcast. I am Amanda Palmer. Thank you so much to my guest, Nadia from Pussy Riot, for having this conversation with me. And please, please go support her on Patreon. She is there at patreon.com/PussyRiot. She's got about 250 supporters. If we could get her a couple hundred more, I know it would make a huge difference to her life and her work and her ability to make unfettered art without the system. There's lots of other links to her music and books and schedule in the show notes on my Patreon. And for all the music that you heard in this episode, you can go to the new and improved amandapalmer.net/podcast and click on this episode. This podcast was produced by Fanny Co. Lots and lots of thanks are due to my incredible team, especially Haley Rosenblum. She is the ghost in the machine of my Patreon, and she makes sure that so many things get done: words, pictures, the live chats, and all the general internet love. She is one of my biggest helpers, and I could not do this without her. My assistant, Michael McComiskey, makes sure all of the schedules and the trains run on time, and I am not able to do this without him either, so thank you, Michael. Our merch queen, Alex Knight, is also helping us transcribe this podcast and lift quotes and work on everything in the background, so thank you, Alex, for that, for making these conversations accessible to everyone. And of course, as always, my manager, Jordan Verzar, helps us all bring it all together. Thank you, Jordan. And last but not least, this whole podcast would not be possible without all of my patrons. At current count, we've got somewhere between 14,000 and 15,000 of them. And these people make it possible for this podcast to have no ads, no sponsors, no censorship, no bullshit. We are just the media making our things and doing what we do. This is a homegrown product without any help from above. So special thanks are due to my high-level patrons who give a lot of money: Simon Oliver, St. Alexander, Bertie Black, Ruth Ann Harnish, and Leela Cosgrove. Thank you so much, you guys, for helping us make this. Everyone else, please go to my Patreon, become a supporting member. This will also give you access to the follow-up live chat that I have every week with my podcast guest. That usually comes out a few days after the podcast, and we talk deeper about the issues. We ask and answer questions from the community. They're really, really, really good. So please join us for that. You can find me anywhere on social media at Amanda Palmer. And the Patreon is also full of extra things like pictures and da 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 about the podcast. Please go there and find out more about me and Nadja and all of this good stuff. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Signing off, this is Amanda fucking Palmer. Keep on pussy rioting and keep on asking everything.